Hi, and welcome to the Toolkit Podcast. I'm Chris O'Fall, Executive Editor of Craft and Special Projects at IndieWire. And my guest today is Love Lies Bleeding director Rose Glass. It was clear off St. Maud that Rose had the potential to be a really special filmmaker, but nothing about that film, which I loved, prepared me for Love Lies Bleeding. Rose's filmmaking chops are off the chart in this one. She goes hard in this kind of cosmic, violent, sexy thriller set in the 80s. The film stars Kristen Stewart opposite newcomer Katie O'Brien, with supporting in really creepy turns by Ed Harris and Dave Franco. It's in theaters from A24. It went wide last weekend. As usual, I'm going to highly recommend you go see this film first before listening to this conversation, but in particular with this one, fair warning, the second half of this podcast does deal with the film's big third act spoiler. Rose was lovely, brilliant filmmaker. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
I know people have asked you a lot about influences and specific influences in films. In terms of raw material, though, it strikes me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, maybe one of the building blocks here is an archetype of filmmaking, an archetype of type of storytelling that kind of, I want to do something with that. Am I wrong here?
No. I co-wrote it with Veronica Tafilska, who's also a filmmaker, and we weren't sort of referencing lots of specific films as we were writing it, but we were definitely aware of leaning into kind of tropes and archetypes of sort of what you would expect to happen next, and sort of use that to hopefully set up expectations and then hopefully do something different instead.
Because there's something I instantly started thinking, and maybe it's just because in the 80s, some of these thrillers could go harder. They could be a little bit more transgressive. There's something there about even like a thriller, that ability to do something that we don't get to see right now. I think part of it's because they go so hard too.
Yes. I'm trying to think which, I mean, yeah, I knew going into it, I didn't want to hold back in any way. And I guess maybe I'm just a bit melodramatic. I just quite like stuff that goes very over the top, gleefully so, I think. Yes, the 80s did definitely feel like an appropriate decade to set it in.
Part of this, you live in London now. That's also, you're London based. That's where you grew up in the UK.
Yeah.
Because there's an element here also of Americana. And I'm sure you've been here before too, before making this, but it almost feels like a movie sense of Americana.
I've barely been here. I'd barely been here before making the film. And yeah, like I said, I'm English and Veronica, she's Polish. Neither of us has spent much time here before. I'd never been to that bit of the country until we were looking for locations. So it's definitely a version of America kind of informed far more through a kind of lifetime of watching American films and TV and stuff rather than having too much basis in fact.
Like wanting to play with that landscape, that desert. And
yeah, definitely. I mean, at first I was quite nervous about setting it there. I think in very early iterations, we were sort of trying to figure out a way to make it work in the UK. And we sort of flirted with the idea of Scotland. And it just sort of, the story just didn't seem to, she didn't really buy it there somehow. And then, so I was nervous of setting it in America because I felt a bit unqualified. But once we'd sort of made that decision, yeah, it just sort of opens you up to, well, again, it's kind of like leaning into the archetypes, I suppose. And there's so much sort of, in a way, I felt by leaning into the really recognizable elements of it with a lot of the sort of deserty landscape and sort of how we're, you know, there's a lot of famous kind of crime characters and romances set in the 80s around that time. But in a way, sort of, I feel like if you've got a foot in this really recognizable, like almost mythological symbolism of a lot of the kind of American Southwest, it kind of then lets you go off to further weirder extremities if you've got your feet kind of really stuck under the desk.
I'm guessing you ended up in New Mexico like everybody else does because of money, because of tax credits. But I mean, New Mexico's a big place, so you have a lot of choices there. I'm curious, like, what did you tell your location scout? Like, I want to go, I'm looking for. Like, did you go look at a bunch of different places and where did you settle?
That's a lie. We went to Albuquerque. And yeah, I think we checked out a bunch of like smaller little kind of like satellite towns around there. Did we go to Truth or Consequences? There's that town where the awful, where the toy box killer was. A lot of murders and stuff seemed to happen in New Mexico, it seemed, once we started looking into it. So we checked out a few other smaller towns, but Albuquerque just, and at first, I think before we went there, we were worried that maybe Albuquerque would feel like too big of a town. But then once we got there, and yeah, we had this amazing location manager, Deborah, who, I can't remember what brief I gave. I guess you basically just give them like a breakdown of like all the key scenes. And there's quite a lot of different little locations in this. We sort of had like the gun range that Lucina runs, Lou's apartment, the gym, and then obviously like this giant crack in the earth, which I think is one of those things you just kind of write in, and then you're like, oh shit, we've got to actually, how do we do that now?
That wasn't an effect. I just assumed it was an effect.
Well, it was in the end. So it was more a case of like giving her this list of like, okay, we need somewhere where we can get to all of these places without losing too much time transport. So Albuquerque just seemed to have everything. But yeah, the bit with the crack in the earth, that was one of those locations we sort of wanted it to feel ancient, I guess. And, you know, a lot of the town and stuff feels a bit sort of more gritty and real worldy, but we wanted to, for there to be a place which felt sort of otherworldly and would sort of allow us to kind of lean into some of these more ridiculous kind of genre bits. It's basically where Lucina's kind of like dumping all his bodies and stuff. But it was very hard to find. We basically, Deborah sort of and her team sort of took us to, there's a gypsum mine in Albuquerque or next to Albuquerque, which I think probably loads of stuff has shot at. And I didn't know the word gypsum, but that's, you guys all know what
that
is.
Okay.
They were like, oh, that's what we call it here. I was like, well, it's kind of a sort of like chalky sort of, like if you plaster a wall or something, it's sort of the stuff that you make plaster from. Anyway, so it's, but mined in this place, so it's the very lunar, weird, big white kind of landscape. And yeah, we VFX'd a giant crack in there. But initially, oh, sorry, this is probably boring, but it was this giant crack. And then we got to Albuquerque and we were prepping for like, I don't know, maybe even like 6-8 weeks or something. And that was the hardest location to find. And initially, we wanted to do this whole shot where there's like a forensic guy on a rope. And, you know, we do this whole shot going down into the crack. And at the very bottom, you find everything, which was just a nightmare. And then we found a location. And it fell through because another show, I won't say which one, had been there and apparently left the location in a terrible state. So then the people were like, no, no one can film here. And we're like, fuck. So then we found the gypsum mine, which didn't have a crack. So at one point we sort of changed it at the last minute in prep so that it wouldn't be a crack in the earth. It just was a gypsum mine. And we had this hold. So this is like the perils of doing last minute script changes because of sort of, you know, production stuff that comes up. So we did actually in the initial shoot shot a slightly different version where it's, you know, they go and dump this car, but it doesn't vanish. It just goes off the edge of a cliff. And, you know, we just, which is what we did kind of practically. And so you just saw this burning car and it's just in this big open, like, crater, like gypsum mine. And then we had like a mine supervisor character who like finds it. Anyway, story-wise, it didn't work. So then in post, we had to retroactively be like, I really would think we should keep it as a big crack. Can you just give us some more money for VFX? And we just sort of turned it into a big crack.
It freaks me. I don't know, maybe it's my own phobias, but that crack freaked me out and haunted me after. Maybe it does Ed Harris, but I don't know, there's something about that thing.
Ed Harris hiding at the bottom.
Yeah, I just okay. Even just being in the, like, what's it, even when they go down into the, like, they have to go look for, oh, it's just the whole thing. I'm curious, are you someone, a filmmaker, when you're, I guess maybe even the writing phase, thinking in terms of sound?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a part of it that I really enjoy. I mean, and I work with Paul Davies on this one, who is the sound designer on St. Maud as well, and he's brilliant, and he works on like Lynn Ramsey's films and a very cool creative guy. I don't know, he's particularly good at a lot of this very kind of like heightened, quite dark, visceral sort of stuff. And that was sort of probably a big breakthrough even in just making shorts, is kind of realizing how much that can elevate things.
I love St. Maud. I love St. Maud. I love this film. But one of the things that I, and because I working in this job, I see a lot of first-time filmmakers. And to me, it's something like St. Maud, one of the things that I think instantly registers with me in terms of someone is you can see the ones that think in terms of sound, because when it's missing, they've been thinking visual the whole time. It's like, doesn't really, you can't, especially someone like, you can't get to some of these places that you're taking us without like some kind of...
Yeah, definitely.
Like the motion almost comes through with it. No?
Yes. And I mean, and then, yeah, this one, I wanted it to be especially kind of visceral and sensory. And I think probably main note to every head of department usually tended to be more bigger. So, I mean, obviously there's a fair amount of sound stuff written into the script, but obviously not nearly as much as what Paul and his team then kind of bring on top. But even like, it's just exciting seeing the whole film kind of come into focus, I guess, with each step of, you know, obviously you lock the edit and then you do the track play, but it's only when you're there in the mix, it's just so nice because for a while it feels, you know, you've just been fine-tuning the cut and it all feels like stuff's maybe got a bit stale. And so then just doing the mix, it's like that last bit where you just go.
Because there's a few different things, and maybe this also blends into music, and maybe this also comes to even where I'm thinking of the 80s, is just there's a certain sound, like a fuzz. There's something like electric. I don't have the right vocabulary for this aspect of it, but there's just something that I have to assume is like kind of intrinsic to how you thought of this project, that there's, it almost reminds me of that music that no one listens to anymore from that era. Well, maybe you do, but it's just, there's something about this electricity or I don't know what, maybe you could talk about that.
Well, there's probably a lot of sounds in the film which are kind of elements of the music which sort of work a bit like sound design, but then even, I don't know, even like in the gym and stuff, yeah, you're right, there's a lot of these kind of like fuzzy kind of fluorescent light bulbs with bugs fuzzing around them, so you can lean into that. And, you know, one of our lead characters, Jackie, she's kind of pumping all these steroids and losing her mind and is obviously in this kind of big pressure cookery kind of situation. And yeah, just sounds just one of the main things at our disposal there to really sort of put you in her head, so you're not just watching, you're actually kind of feeling it. A lot of fuzzy static TVs, a lot of buzzing, droning, general.
And what about the music and the tracks you guys pull? Because Clint Mansell did the score, right? I got that right. He certainly has his roots in. There's something here, even with the 80s, I don't recognize any of these songs. I mean, they're not instantly recognizable, but there's something, a feel.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about them?
Sure. Clint did an amazing score, and that's like a huge part of it as well. But I'd say it's almost like half and half between original score and licensed music. And I mean, there's obvious bits where it's used, like, you know, the track that Jackie's dancing to and stuff that's obviously a song that we've licensed. But there's also a lot of commercial tracks which are sort of laid in like score and then kind of, you know, drift in and out of what Clint's doing. And I think like the 80s was just a decade that it's sort of just been so done to death in films. Yeah, I think I was just very aware of wanting to avoid the temptation of filling it with lots of familiar kind of needle drops. So I actually worked with the music consultant, Yeet Bulbul, and he basically got him in prep to come up with all these kind of like playlists of what we thought like the main two characters might listen to. So maybe unsurprisingly, Jackie's was a bit more kind of needle droppy, and we were kind of thinking she'd be listening to whatever was on the radio at the time. But then Lou, I kind of figured I liked the idea of her sort of being a bit of more of a like a nerdy sort of record collector and sort of taking pride in like being able to sort of wheedle out the stuff. She's like, no one else listens to this.
Deep cuts.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all stuff from the 80s, but I guess, yes, slightly more alternative kind of acts like Throbbing Gristle and Martin Rev. Although I think, and Patrick Cowley, I think there's a few films that have used some of their stuff. But like Patrick Cowley was a musician who I think started off doing music for like gay porn films in the 70s or 80s and then became this like early pioneer of electronic dance music. So there's stuff like that, which I thought maybe Lou might listen to, but then also this Japanese composer or musician, sorry, Shiho Yabuki, who does all these beautiful, I think it's called, what did she call it, healing music or something. So there's this amazing album we took a couple of tracks from, which sounds all kind of a bit sci-fi and twinkly. It's all synthy, but I think she's a magician as well or something like that. And this sort of, I think the idea is it's all very like bodily, sensory kind of music. And there's something a little bit kind of sci-fi and alien about it.
That's what I was about to ask. Those are the kind of more cosmic beats, right?
Yeah, exactly. Generally the kind of like, I think Clint kind of imbued that he basically sort of, I think, gives the film like an engine and a lot of this kind of much more deep, throbbing kind of slightly more menacing. And then basically like a lot of the commercial tracks, we had those in really early in the edit, and a lot of that makes up the more kind of like slightly more playful, sexy, twinkly, synthy sort of stuff, which I think gives it quite a lot of its personality. And then Clint came in much later in post, and I think it was kind of like, yeah, the real kind of like driving engine, and he sort of gives things a real sense of scale, I think, and ancient sort of feeling. So hopefully, yeah, it's a good interplay between the two.
Again, please, if I'm going off the deep end here, but it feels to me, and since you're talking about a couple of those tracks, the ones twinkly is a good word for it, it feels like there's an intentional aspect here and for all the different things that we've been talking about, a little touch of sci-fi, a little touch of the cosmic, maybe even wrapping their love story in a little bit of that. Maybe it's even just all those stars and coming down, and there's something sometimes the surface feels like lunar. Now, there's something, of course, there's where the story goes, but it feels like that's another thing that you needed to build in there to a certain degree. Is it a little bit of a, am I wrong, a little sci-fi, a little cosmic?
Yeah, no. I mean, that was all stuff that kind of came a bit gradually. I mean, there's an obvious big sort of story beat towards the very end of the film, which is, in hindsight, yeah, quite reminiscent of a particular sci-fi B-movie of the past. But a lot of that stuff, like the you know, putting all the twinkly stars in the sky in the earlier shots, that sort of came more as a response to that particular bit of music that we then put in that moment, and we just happened to have this big empty
just
sky.
Kind of keeps and growing.
Yeah, exactly. And then sort of having filmed all this stuff at this gypsum mine place, which does look a bit like they're on the moon. I had to come up with the names for all of the different places, including like the gun range. So we called it Louville because Lou's dad, Lou, is a narcissist. But then it turned out that apparently Louville's the name of a crater on the moon. So that's why we then called the town
kind of
Crater.
It's kind of one of these things. Maybe
just
you're
making it up
more,
as we go along.
You're leaning more and more into it.
Yeah.
And is that because of where you're going? No, I saw the movie. When I saw the Sundance, I would have gone wherever you took me, you know, at that, by the time we got to the third act. But I'm wondering, and this is the part where it might get a little spoilery, and if you haven't seen it, then, you know, you should go see it you should have seen it anyway. In rewatching it this morning and thinking about where this goes, I'm starting to imagine that's something that almost has to retrofit. Like, you have to lay it. I imagine that's the first thing that people ask you about is, like, what happens in the third act? You
know,
but like, with reading the script, like, the sense that you have to set, like, some kind of foundation to go where you go.
But so, it's, say again, so how laying the foundation for the weirdness that happens later?
Let's talk about that. Like, was that where this goes? I think anybody who's seen the films knows what we're talking about. Was that part of this from the start? Is that,
Yes. Pretty early on. I know, well, me and Vera, we definitely went through a few different iterations of the ending, and I think we'd maybe had a much earlier one which did that, and then we sort of chickened out and we're like, oh no, surely we can't do that, and then we sort of tried something more sensible, which is sort of probably in real life terms. Obviously it's not real life anyway, but what literally happens. I think we maybe did that, but we just really missed what we'd come up with first.
I'm sure it would have been good if it wrapped up like a crime, you know, it wrapped up.
I'm sure so many people agree with you. Like, what?
I'm sure it would have worked. There was part of me, I was like, is this going to wrap up like Bound or something? Like, there was part of me that was like as I was watching it, but then that transcends and it keeps going.
Yeah.
It goes there, feels
we'd already
feels
kind
special.
Of been, we'd already kind of been layering in all of these sort of slightly more fantastical body beats with Jackie throughout the film. And I think, to be honest, in the script, there's, you know, from quite early on in the film, and it's like, oh, is it because of the steroids, or is it maybe it coincides more with when she's met Lou? But for whatever reason you choose to go with, she has these kind of, we hint at something kind of more fantastical happening with her physically. So it felt like it was a cop-out to not follow through on that. It just felt like, I don't know, you just sort of, even though it's not a literal thing, it's like hopefully it just gives you more the feeling of where those guys are at that point, which felt a bit more sort of true to their kind of story and those two emotionally, the romance and all that kind of side of it, as opposed to keeping it in a very literal crime thriller thing. I tried to have my cake and eat it. I'm not sure.
I can't quite put it into any, I'm not an English professor. But there's something that feels so vital to what you do here about her body. And there's something about the body. I don't know if it's a body horror. There's something about this that just seems inseparable from...
Well, for me, I mean, cause, you know, the starting thing was wanting to do a film about a woman who's a bodybuilder. So like that sort of relationship with the body, and I guess just the style of filmmaking that I'm interested in. To me, it always felt like it was naturally going to go somewhere like that. It was just figuring
out
exactly.
How often did you get notes about that part, though?
Weirdly, not. I don't know if we did. I think it's one of those, I can't remember now. I think it was one of those things that maybe because it was so kind of ridiculous, everyone just kind of went, okay, cool, fine, yeah, let's just go with that.
Was it hard? Is it one of those things that's hard to figure out then how to do it?
Yes. I had no idea how to do it. I was kind of one of
the... I even think just in the smaller things, like, because it's like even, you got to do a little with the, even just the, when it's before.
Yeah, the sort
act,
of like slightly Popeye kind
yeah,
of bits.
Yeah. Well, something's going on that's beyond
yes,
her roiding.
Exactly. I mean, some of those beats we sort of added during post, like there were, we realized we needed more of them. So there's a few shots where it's just like big close-ups of Jackie's arms kind of, you know, like swelling and stuff. So those are just fully VFX. And we had this amazing company, Time-Based Arts, who are based in the UK. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of, it's usually just a mix of, I mean, I think we decided pretty early on we weren't going to do practical muscle effects, even though I kind of really love the idea of doing that. It's actually a whole sort of nightmare once you get into it. And I think sticking with VFX just keeps things a lot more open, I guess. And we sort of played with what that effect would look like. And I think in the script, and even when we were shooting, it was going to be more obviously magical and kind of actually start like glowing from inside. And we did start. And I sort of maybe at one point I was like, maybe even the steroids themselves should glow so they're even less... You know, I never was particularly interested in doing a film that's like about the true sort of realities of what taking steroids would be like. So we're definitely having a lot of creative leeway there, obviously, given what happens at the end. But yeah, I'd kind of wondered whether it should be more magical and the stuff should be glowing, but it just felt a bit distracting. So that was something. So the actual look of what happens with her muscles, that was kind of a thing we went back and forth on a bit in post. But yeah, that's all the most fun stuff to do really and to figure out. And then the big thing that happens at the end. Yeah, I mean, like, she turns into a giant. We've seen it. It's like they show everything in the trailer anyway. But I kind of feel like even knowing that, it's... hopefully that doesn't ruin anything. It's still very enjoyable. But yeah, I was not quite sure how to do that. Although I think probably that's just because I've only done one film and this was the first time I had like this bigger scale to work with. So it was like, oh, cool, great. So we did... Yeah, we obviously shot Jackie, like Katie against grey screen, and then had a lot of fun doing these kind of like plate shots of Ed and Kristen's characters reacting to her appearing, which was... So that's the first time I had a little taste of doing the sort of stuff where actors are just reacting to tennis balls on lighting stands and stuff, which is very fun. Very weird. You're like, okay, now she's appearing, she's coming, she's picking you up, Ed, and go.
Intrinsic in this is a bodybuilder. And I think you've had Kristen Stewart signed on for this. So you got to find someone that there's a chemistry there. Was there an element, I'd heard maybe that you found Katie late?
Yeah.
There's a thing here, you see it with filmmakers once in a while when they have a musician in there, do I cast a musician and turn him into an actor or vice versa? Like, bodybuilder is going to have great chemistry with Kristen Stewart. Like, I mean, like, you got very lucky, but is there a point of, like, you know, finding that person?
Yeah, it was very, it was getting very close to the wire. We'd already been out in Albuquerque for several weeks prepping and, yeah, it was even less than I thought. Katie says it was from the point where she actually got confirmed she was going to be in it to the point where she was on set was like a couple of weeks or something. So it was all getting very nail-biting. Yeah, I'd said we started looking really early on, and Betty May, our casting directors, were fantastic, you know, and we'd sort of cast everyone else, and I'd been saying that I wanted to find an actual bodybuilder or someone who was... Because, I don't know, the story's just a bit limp if it keeps...
You can't just find someone that's a bodybuilder has a very... You can't just be someone that's very strong, is in shape and buff. Like, that
yes,
bodybuilder...
There's no shortcut to it. And I think that's what I found kind of interesting in the first place. It's all incredibly undeniable. Like, the only way you get looking like that is just a huge amount of work over a really long period of time. Consistency, discipline, stuff I don't have. But she thought that was really important. And somehow I naively thought it would be easy to find. I was kind of like, you know, bodybuilding's kind of a performative thing. There must be loads of amazing actors who are also bodybuilders and... I think it was much harder than I thought. So we met a lot of really wonderful performers who were great, but didn't quite have the acting chops to sort of like, you know, carry a film, which is a two-hander. And then, yeah, you end up having these conversations where people start going, maybe we could cast such and such famous actor. And, you know, we know this great trainer and give them 3 months. You know, it's amazing. And yeah, and I knew I didn't want to do that. But then you end up having even weirder conversations about like, oh, well, maybe we cast X, but we get a body double and we get like some prosthetics that they can wear on their arms or VFX. And then you're just like, oh, God, this just sounds like a nightmare. So, yeah, it was very nerve wracking. And in hindsight, we were like, why didn't we find her before? But yeah, Katie, I think Betty May had eventually put out a casting call on Twitter. And somebody who was a fan of Katie's from another film she'd done sent her the link and was like, oh, you should go for this. And then Katie kind of literally like tweeted at us, I think, and sent in a thing to Betty May. And it was all like, oh, thank God. I mean, really, thank God. Like we would have been screwed. Like I wasn't, it was a massive relief. Because she's, I don't know, she sort of has all the, obviously she needed to have this kind of, she can have like an imposing sort of physicality, or you know, she's obviously incredibly muscular and she can sort of switch into the whole kind of like action hero thriller scary sort of stuff, but you know, she herself and what she's doing more in the film is actually, I don't know, she's kind of the innocent of the film, even though she does all this terrible stuff. She's kind of, there's something quite there's like a sweetness, softness kind of to her, and she's incredibly, I don't know, vulnerable, and I don't know, I just think she's a fascinating performer, and yeah, we're incredibly lucky that she found us.
beyond finding the right person, it's got Kristen and Katie have to have something out. I mean, I know chemistry is something that can sometimes be a filmmaking thing too, but not always, right? Like, I mean, like, this is like, there's got to be something going.
I don't know. I mean, I've sort of gone back because I sort of found myself in interviews sort of being like, oh, yeah, I guess there's kind of like chemistry is this magical thing. And now I'm kind of like, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just we cast the right people and they're both really good actors. So it's like, I mean, you know, they got on really well, but, you know, we're all just, they didn't, it's not like we had a chance to, you know, they met each other in the chemistry read. And then the next time they met each other, we were on set. I think we did like one sort of camera test, which we were mostly just worrying about Katie's wig at that point. So they didn't, you know, and I think maybe the three of us in the days leading up to the shoot, once we were all out in Albuquerque, I think we like read through the script together once and kind of talked through each scene and what's going on. But no, I think they're both just really good actors. And yeah, everything that everyone else is doing is hopefully just in service of trying to make these two fictional people have something real.
We keep having in this country, and it's not fun, conversations about sex scenes and their place in movies. And I feel like one thing that's always missing from that conversation is how bad these sex scenes are that we're talking about. And I feel like maybe that would help a lot if they were better. Yeah. You have some wonderful, I mean, just some great sex scenes in this movie. You interviewed with, there's a great article with our Ryan LaTanzia, and you talked about how you feel about sex and violence in movies, and it's great, and I refer people there. But what is the key to making a good sex scene? Because it feels like something, a lot of people know how to do the giant. It's missing completely from, I don't know if it's an overabundance of porn. I don't know what it is, but it's like no one seems to be able to get it right.
I'm sure that's not true, but it's, I think it's, I don't know. I'd say it's sort of just treating it like any other scene in the film. And I guess every scene in the film, you want it to be the best version of whatever it is it can be. So it's, I guess, maybe just not thinking about them as now we do the sex scene kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously you want in, you know, when you're doing any kind of scene, you want everybody who's there to be on the same page, be having a good time and not be feeling uncomfortable. And I guess there's just a few more sort of like hoops to go through to facilitate that when shooting scenes like these, same way as you get a stunt coordinator or whatever if you were doing a, because I think Kristen was saying it when we were doing some of these interviews and can completely empathize with, I don't think it's difficult to imagine that being an actor, the last thing you want is kind of some awkward director being like, oh, and then, okay, then I guess you have sex, just go with it kind of thing. It's like, that would obviously be excruciating. So yeah, you just kind of plan it very specifically. I mean, it's all kind of written out, hopefully as kind of explicitly and specifically as you can in the script.
There is some specificity there.
There is specificity, yes, exactly. But I think, well, because otherwise you do the whole kind of, and then the camera pans away. And although we do that at the end of the first sex scene, it's like camera pans away, but just to a bulging Popeye arm, which I think maybe we went a little too subtle on that effect. I feel like maybe some people miss it. I don't know. I just think of it like choreography, really. Like you sort of, you just need to sort of know exactly what's happening when. Don't be shy about it, I guess. If you've done stuff right, it just means that by the time you're shooting it, you've already had a million conversations, both with just the intimacy coordinator and both the cast. They've chatted separately by themselves with the intimacy coordinator, so they know exactly what's going to be shown from where, exactly what's going to happen. And they've had a chance to say if there's anything they're not up for doing beforehand. So I've had all that information relayed to me beforehand as well. So everyone kind of just goes into it. And then when you actually get on set, it's quite fun because, you know, you're obviously blocking it out, obviously completely fully clothed and very unsexily with nice intimacy coordinator kind of supervising like a sort of maternal kind of mumsy teacher kind of role. And we're just, I don't know, just playing around.
Rewatching the, I don't know, kitchen counter, whatever, that one this morning, I feel like a perv just saying, I rewound it, rewatched it. It's like some kid with an HBO subscription in the 80s. But
right.
But there's a thing, and maybe it's just that one. There's an editing aspect.
You mean bathroom? No, kitchen counter.
Kristen Stewart comes up.
They're in the bathroom. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's a bathroom? Yeah. Okay, I thought that was a kitchen counter, but it's a bathroom. Okay, yeah. Whatever. Clearly I was paying attention. But actually, that actually might get to my point, is that it feels like allowing yourself to do it in editing. There's a specificity to the action. There's a specificity to the sound and the dialogue. But everything's kind of like... It shows very little.
Yeah.
And even in the lighting, I'm seeing very little. And it's just the frames are tight. And it feels like more like a sense of almost being able to do it with filmmaking than rather... It's not until that last shot that we're even seeing a wide of what's even... the sense of the whole scene.
Yeah, I think people's imaginations fill stuff in. I don't know. That just seemed a bit more of a real way of doing it. It's sort of, I guess in reality, not everyone immediately just takes off all of their clothes and does things in the most kind of easy to film kind of way. So we kind of, I mean, that bathroom was tiny, so there wasn't many ways of shooting it in anything other than big close-ups. I mean, what they're describing doing, like with their hands and stuff, like we obviously couldn't show anyway, and nor would I want to. I think it's sort of just a bit sexier leaving stuff to people's imaginations whilst also describing what they're doing quite explicitly. I think that seems quite sweet.
On the opposite end, being explicit and showing gore seems to be a big part of
what. Not on the other hand.
But I feel like on the opposite side, even some of these things, when it comes to violence, there is an aspect of this film where really seeing certain, like that image of Franco's head is still haunts
that
me.
I have to fully credit Time Based Arts with. We basically like filmed, because at first I really wanted to like show the moment where he gets his head smashed in. More spoilers. Some of the sort of what to show, what not to show does come down to, a lot of it does come kind of with the sex scenes as well, it does come down to practicalities as well. So, you know, I kind of really wanted to have the big money shot of his head kind of splitting open on this table, but then it's just very difficult to do because then you start getting into sort of like prosthetics and all these things, which we kind of realized, we tried to look into that and basically said, okay, we can't afford to do it like that. Let's play that beat off screen. And then it ends up working better because then Paul...
Because if I remember correctly, the thing that haunted me was when Kristen Stewart discovers.
Well, we played it out on Katie's face as she's doing it. Yeah. And so you just, Paul and all the sound department just had a lot of fun just doing all these horrible off-screen sounds, which again, I think people's imaginations fill it in better. And so, yeah, then the aftermath we only reveal later when Kristen's character finds him in a beat, which I find really funny because I really love Kristen's reaction. And she said to me, she's like, well, I didn't know his face was going to look like that because we did it all in post.
Oh, that reaction.
So she didn't see what his face actually looked like until she'd seen the finished film. And she was like, my reaction's way too small. But that's why I really like it. It's just really, which actually makes perfect sense because like she's seen some stuff, which we don't realize at that point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she literally sort of reacts like a kind of like secret squirrel, like kind of like, oh no. So that we just had a plate of him lying there dead with just basically just red on the bottom half of his face and some dots. And then we basically gave those shots to Time Based Arts and were like, what can you do with this? And then they came up with that wonderful composition, which then only once they'd done that, we realized, then there's that shot later on where they put his body in the trunk. That means we can have a fun, like flapping jaw.
But that is part of this though. There is something in your vision here that there is something, and people have made reference to body horror. I don't know what it is, but there's something that's important for you, and it feels in watching the film that there is a little bit of that. That there's the physicality of it, the violent, the aftermath of it, right?
Oh, definitely. I like all of the visceral, violent, bloody, gooey stuff. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's the sort of stuff I'm kind of interested in or find. I like films that sort of make you feel something kind of physically, I guess, whether that's revulsion or arousal. I'm not sure if that's what I want to say. But, you know, sensual and grotesque, I guess. I kind of like it when those two things sort of go hand in hand. So even though it's kind of, yeah, I know some people are just like, oh, the film's a bit gross. I'm kind of, hopefully it's kind of sensual and nice to look at as well.
Before I let you go, I wanted to, and we've talked about a lot of different ingredients here. Your cinematographer is Ben, right?
Ben Fordsman.
Ben Fordsman.
He did St. Maud as well.
What were you thinking in terms of your references in terms of how you wanted this to look? Because there's something, it has a very distinct feel, and even texture to things.
I'm trying to remember because I got asked this a few things. I'm sure we did have references and lookbooks and stuff, and probably just spent lots of time on shot deck being like, so I'm sure we did have sort of images where it was like, you mean this kind of color temperature, this kind of look.
Larry Shearer just got very excited. Ooh, they mentioned shot deck.
Hey, wonderful, wonderful thing. So I'm sure we did do all that, but it's not like, I feel like when we did St. Maud together, it was a lot more like, Ben, like, you know, let's both make sure we watch these films and we'll be thinking about specifically referencing that shot from this film. So I think with this, because of the, you know, the sort of oversaturated kind of 80s Americana of it. There were so many films that I was just self-conscious of it being too pastiche. So it was more kind of cherry picking. I mean, I don't know, probably like, I know Paris, Texas, in terms of some of the kind of colour, lighting sort of way that kind of landscape shot.
The nighttime and some of the stuff, that's what I connected to. And like there's a distinct look of night.
Yeah, and I knew I wanted a lot of the film to take place at night. And I feel like we were probably slightly just building on the sort of visual style we'd shot St. Maud in. So I think that naturally we had a bit of a shorthand, and it's sort of, yeah, I guess sort of trying to constantly balance this thing of it being kind of in the real world, but also kind of not, and being quite, I don't know, with all the departments. I know I just kept using I kept saying, you know, texture, I think, was quite a big one. You know, obviously, like, probably had the same argument everyone does in every film with their producers, like, we want to shoot it on film. And then they go, no. And we're like, please. And then they say no. And then we go, fine. So, you know, we didn't shoot it on film, but we had to. So, you know, the grade was very important. Vanessa, our colorist, is brilliant. But it was in all aspects trying to add texture, and never wanted it to feel too clean or cartoony, and to always feel kind of grungy. Again, that's sort of why I think at first I was a bit resistant to setting it in the 80s. I kept sort of being like, oh, I kind of want it to feel a bit more 90s. So it's sort of maybe a slightly more 90s sensibility. I mean, with all of that, it's just kind of lots of little conversations and constantly kind of trying to feel it out, I guess. And Ben's just incredibly talented.
I only know his work from the two films, but I'm very impressed.
He did another film with Oliver Kassman, one of our two producers on this, who also produced St. Maud. With Andrea Cornwell, but Oliver did another feature film by Andrew Cumming, a debut called Out of Darkness, which is excellent, and which Ben shot that as well. I think that came out recently. So I'd urge people to check that out too.
Now that we're so, I love your first two films, and now I'm already for the next one. Off two features, do you have a sense of a rhythm here of how often? Do you know, like, I feel like after a while people realize I'm like an every 3 year filmmaker.
I think I'm quite slow, to be honest.
Yeah, like, I was wondering because it's also hard because I feel like we might have a false sense of, because St. Maud kind of got delayed a little bit because COVID,
yeah,
right?
Technically, so, we finished it in 2018, 2019.
So, yes.
In 2018. And then it came out.
Sat on it till they could put it in,
yes,
the theater, right?
Yeah, our first poster's like coming like April 2020. And then like, no. So it came out, I think, yeah, we premiered at Toronto in 2019. It came out late in 2020. So delayed a bit. But I was already writing this with Veronica sort of during lockdown. And I think we'd started before then. I mean, I'd have thought the fact that we were writing together, it felt like we wrote it a lot quicker than I wrote St. Maud, because I was sort of sitting on that for ages. And I think I'm just a bit slow at writing, and sort of a big procrastinator. And so I'm kind of writing something now, but it's, you know, it's, I've obviously like paused it quite heavily recently with this coming out. So I'd sort of had a similar feeling after Maud was sort of finished, though it's sort of not until you've sort of pushed it out into the world that you kind of have a clear sense of what sort of feeling you want for the next one. So I'm hoping now that this will give me a good kick up the arse to hurry up a bit and get on with it.
Well, I love this film. I love the fact that people are seeing it now and getting to see it. Can't wait for the next one, maybe 2027.
Exactly. No, my agent's like, hurry up. Good. Any day now.
But congratulations on this one.
Thanks so much. Really nice to talk to you.